Saviors of the Islamic Spirit by Sheikh Abu al-Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 9. Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi presents another striking example of a preacher, reformer, and renovator of the faith. He was the most reputed and profound scholar of his time and a prolific writer of voluminous books on the tafsir of the Quran, traditions, history, and literary criticism. Early life of Ibn al-Jawzi. Born in 508 AH at Baghdad, Ibn al-Jawzi was 38 years younger than Abdul Qadir. His father died when he was still young, but his mother sent him to study under reputed traditionalists of the time, Ibn Nasir. He committed the Quran to memory and learnt its recitation, studied the traditions and calligraphy. Describing his childhood days to his son, Ibn al-Jawzi says in the following words, "I quite recollect that I was admitted to the primary school at the age of 6. Boys much more elder than me were my classmates. I do not recollect if I had ever spent my time in playing or laughing with other boys. Instead of witnessing the performance of jugglers who frequently held their shows in the field in front of the mosque where I studied, I used to attend lectures on traditions. Whatever traditions or biographical accounts of the Prophet were related in the lectures, those who were memorized by me, and then I used to take them down on reaching them home. Other boys spent their time in playing along the banks of the river, but I invariably used it to sit down with a book in my hand in a corner and read it from cover to cover. I was always so anxious to attend classes in time that I often doubled up to reach the school before the lectures began. It was not unoften that I had nothing to eat for the whole day, but I'm thankful to God that I have never had occasion to be grateful to anybody in that connection." Zeal for the Traditions by Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi had an immense enthusiasm for acquiring knowledge and propagating the traditions of the Apostle of God, the Prophet of Islam. His works on the subject were so numerous that, as the chroniclers of the time, Ibn al-Jawzi had made a will that the water for the ritual washing of his body should be heated by burning the clippings and ends of his pen used for writing the traditions of the Prophet. It was further related that these clippings were found more than sufficient for the purpose of washing his body after his death. Ibn al-Jawzi was a voracious reader from a very early age. In his time, Baghdad had well-stocked libraries where he used to spend most of his time. He read whatever book he could lay his hands on. In one of his books entitled Sayyid al-Khatir, an autobiographical memoir, he writes in his following words, "I may state here my own cast of mind. I am never tired of reading a book, and my joy knows no bounds whenever I found a new book. It would appear to be an exaggeration if I say I had gone through 20,000 books during my student days. I came to know of the courage and large-heartedness and the tenacious memory, piety and eagerness for prayer cherished by the Sabians of the old, which I could not have learnt without reading these books. The study of the books in those days also revealed to me the shallow knowledge of the scholars in our times and the dull spirits of the students nowadays." The penmanship of Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi turned to writing from an early age. He began writing 4 folios daily and continued the practice throughout his life. Ibn Taymiyyah relates that when he took a stock of Ibn al-Jawzi's books, they were found to be more than 1,000 in number. Ibn al-Jawzi had such profound knowledge of the science of the traditions that he claimed to tell the authenticity, or otherwise, of any tradition with reference to the characters of those whom the traditions had been handed down on, and with reference to the manner in which it had been narrated. He was also without a peer as a literator and an orator. The piety of Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi was a much celebrated for his moral uprightness, devotion, and piety as for his literary achievements. His grandson, Abdul Muzaffar, relates that Ibn al-Jawzi completed recitation of the Quran every week. He never spent his time in fun or frolics during his childhood and never ate anything unless he was sure that it had been obtained through lawful means. Ibn Najjar records that in religious devotions and observance of prayers, he presented a sublime picture of saintliness. Another analyst, Ibn al-Farsi, says that Ibn al-Jawzi kept vigils by night and was never forgetful of the recollection of God. The works of Ibn al-Jawzi present a striking example of his fervent devotion and heartfelt love of God. In an autobiographical passage included in the Sayyid al-Khadr, he writes, "From an early childhood, I had an inclination towards the devotion to religious contemplation and worship. I zealously observed obligatory as well as supererogatory prayers and preferred seclusion. Spending my days thus, I felt peace and enlightenment. I extremely regretted the time spent otherwise, for I had an ardent desire to utilize every moment of my life under a diligent consciousness of the omnipresent God. In those days, I felt my heart attuned to God, while my supplications and benedictions were a source of indiscernible pleasure for me. My lectures and discourses, quite effective in those days, it appeared, attracted a few high officials and chiefs who wanted to come closer to me by paying homage and putting themselves at my service. As it were, I too felt inclined towards them, but in their company I lost the sense of peace and sanctifying grace that I enjoyed earlier in my supplications. Thereafter, other functionaries of the government started gaining my favor, with the result that the precautions I used to take earlier in regards to avoiding everything unlawful and doubtful gave place to a sense of complacency. It was still not so deplorable, but gradually my reasoning made the doubtful objects appear as perfectly lawful, and then I realized that I had lost my sense of sublimity and purity of my heart. Instead, it seemed as if a profaneness had taken its place, which gave rise to restlessness in me. I witnessed that my sermons too bore a mark of my anxiety, which caused an ever larger number of people to offer repentance for their sins, while my own guilt weighed heavily on my conscience. This obviously made me still more disturbed, but there seemed to be no way out of this. I visited the tombs of the saints and beseeched God to show me the right path. Ultimately, God helped me, and I again felt an inclination to spend more of my time in prayer and solitude. Now I came to know what was wrong with me, and I'm thankful that my Lord, the most compassionate and the most merciful, for his kindness." The character of Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi is reported to have been a well-built man with handsome features and an imposing countenance. Favored with easy circumstances, he possessed a refined taste, as said by Muwaffaq Abdul Latif, in dress and dietary habits, and was charming and graceful. Another analyst, Ibn al-Daini, relates that Ibn al-Jawzi was a soft-spoken, handsome man of medium height, reputed for his clemency and generosity. Extremely careful of his wealth, he liked what he may have called good things of temperate quality. In the Sayyid al-Khadr and the Tablis o Iblis, he has mentioned his numerous clinical experiences and advised against penance and arduous religious practices which had been introduced by the Iranian mystics. The encyclopedic knowledge of Ibn al-Jawzi. The most outstanding feature of Ibn al-Jawzi's character is his versatility. He towered over his contemporaries in his ardent desire to be well-versed in almost every branch of learning. He has himself described it in some detail in Sayyid al-Khadr. He writes in his following words, The greatest trial for man lies in the loftiness of his ambition. The higher is one's ambition, the loftier aspirations for advancement or success a man has. However, he is sometimes unable to achieve it owing to unfavorable circumstances or because he lacks the means, and this causes dissatisfaction in a man. God has, however, made me so ambitious that I have always had a hankering for something higher, but I have never wished that God might not have made me too ambitious. It is true that life can be fully enjoyed only by a carefree, imprudent, and a listful fellow, but nobody endowed with brains would ever like retrogression of his own intellect simply for the sake of getting more fun out of worldly pleasures. I know of many people who are boastful of their lofty ambitions, but I have found their aspirations really limited to one field of their activity in which they are ardently desirous of achieving success. These people are completely indifferent to their deficiency in other fields. A poet by the name Sharif Razi once said in a couplet, "Ill health is never without a cause, but in my case it is because of too high an aspiration." However, on going through his biographical accounts, I found that he had no ambition except for achieving power and position. It is related that Abu Muslim Khorasani could not sleep well during his youthful days. When asked about the reason for it, he replied, "How can I sleep? Brilliant and ambitious though I am, I have been condemned to lead a life of poverty and obscurity." "Then what would satisfy you?" someone asked him. He replied, "I would be satisfied only if I achieve greatness and power." He was told, "Then try for it." "This would not be possible without putting my life at stake," he replied. He was asked again, "Then why don't you do it?" He said, "Intellect asks me not to run into danger." He was then asked, "What would you do then?" He said, "I would not accept the advice of my intellect and would give myself up for my folly. I will play a desperate game at the bidding of my ambition and seek the help of intellect only where imprudence fails me. I have no other course left, as poverty and obscurity are interdependent." On giving further thought to this self-deluded yet ambitious man, I came to the conclusion that he had not given thought to one of the most important factors, and that was the question of the life to come. He was mad after political power, for which he had to be cruel and unsparging of innocent human life. He just got a fraction of the worldly power and glory and the things he aspired for a short duration of only 8 years. Thereafter, he fell an easy victim to the treachery of Al-Safah, and then his intellect did not come to his aid. It was the same with Al-Mutanabbi too, who was so pretentious of his ambitions, but he was so enamored of worldly success. "My ambition is, however, quite different from theirs. I aspire for a profound knowledge, embracing the entire field of learning, which I know I cannot attain. I want to achieve a thorough and complete knowledge of every branch of learning, which is obviously not possible in a short span of human life. I do not consider anyone perfect in knowledge of a science so long as he lacks perfection in another branch. As for example, if a traditionalist is not a master of jurisprudence too, I consider his knowledge to be incomplete. The imperfection of knowledge, I think, can be attributed to the lack of ambition alone. Not only that, to me, the end of knowledge means an ability to act on it. Thus, what I want is I should be able to combine with all my knowledge the assiduity of Bishr Hafi and the piety of Ma'ruf Karki. But it is hardly possible to achieve these along with preoccupations of studying and teaching and attending to mundane affairs. And this is not all. I aspire to oblige others, but do not want to lie under their obligation. My preoccupation with the studies is an impediment in the ways of my earnings, but I detest to be indebted to anyone or to accept gift from others. I ardently desire to be an author of merit and distinction, but I would also like to have children at some point of time. But both these pursuits stand in a way of solitude and contemplation. I also do like to enjoy the lawful pleasures, but do not possess the means of achieving these pleasures at any point of time. I like delicacies and refinements which my good taste desires. All these, in fact, mean aspiring for diametrical ends. What have those persons to do with these lofty ideals who aspire simply for worldly success, wealth, power, and position? I too want worldly success, but in a manner that I do not have to impair my faith or to expose my learnings or virtuous actions to any risk. Who can appreciate the demands of my ambition? On one hand, I relish the contemplation and prayer, divine manifestation and illumination of heart, but on the other, I have an inclination for the cultivation of knowledge, teaching, and penmanship. The first requires penance, fasting, and seclusion, while the latter demands nourishment and mixing with people. Spiritual contraction is unbearable for me, but making both ends meet for my dependence stands in a way of my spiritual progress. I have endured these strains all through my life and submitted to the will of God, for it seems the path to success and perfection lies through struggles and afflictions. For the lofty ideals, I seek the pleasure of God Almighty. I guard myself to every defilement and take care that not a single moment of my life is spent in any vain effort. Glory be to God if I succeed in my endeavors, but I won't mind if I fail, for the Prophet has said that the intention of the faithful is better than his action. The popular enthusiasm. The sermons delivered by Ibn al-Jawzi were attended by the caliphs, the kings, the chiefs of state, besides the common people of Baghdad. It is reported that his lectures were normally attended by 10 to 15,000 people, and sometimes the number went up to even 100,000. An eloquent speaker as he was, his sermons breathed an almost tragic urgency behind his message which touched the heart of his audience. His soul-stirring calls so carried away the listeners that many of them burst into tears, broke down into hysterical screams, or even tore off their shirts. Innumerable persons offered their repentance for their sins as a result of his sermons. It is estimated that Ibn al-Jawzi secured conversion of 20,000 Christians and Jews, and over 100,000 people made a solemn affirmation to lead a virtual life after listening to his sermons. Ibn al-Jawzi always condemned innovations and unlawful accretions to the faith in his sermons, asking the people to follow the path enjoined by the scriptures and the traditions. Because of Ibn al-Jawzi's profound knowledge and eloquence, as also his popularity, the heretical factions never dared to controvert him, with this result that the orthodox school gained a dominating influence. The caliphs and the nobles of the time became followers of the Hanbali school, which was distinguished for its ardent adherence to the scriptures and the traditions. Literary endeavors of Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi produced some of the most distinguished works which had a profound effect on the subsequent academic endeavors. His writings helped the succeeding generations to keep to the right path as enjoined by the Sharia. In Kitab al-Mawsu'at is Ibn al-Jawzi's chief work on the traditions. In his book, he has discussed all those spurious or weak traditions which were then commonly relied upon by the heretics for spreading beliefs contrary to the authorized teachings of the Orthodox schools, it is true that Ibn al-Jawzi has been too harsh in his judgments, since he has adopted an extremist course in regard to certain issues dealt with by him in the book. Nevertheless, he has performed an invaluable task by exposing the fallacies of the heretics and the innovators. Tablis o Iblis is a critical study of the then Muslim society by Ibn al-Jawzi. In his book, he has made a critical evaluation of the different classes and sections of the Muslim society of his time. He has highlighted their weaknesses, misconceptions, and de-alienated the causes which have given birth to different vices, marrying the faith, actions, and behavior. Ibn al-Jawzi has set forth the habits and customs, faults and self-deceits to which the scholars, the jurists, the preachers, the writers, the rulers and the pious often fall prey. This book is an outstanding example of panoramic character of Ibn al-Jawzi's writing. He shows an awareness of mental, emotional and social attitudes of the different classes of Muslim society, along with the beliefs and doctrines of the heretic sections and the subtle ways in which the heretics mislead others. Critique of the scholars and the administrators. Criticism by Ibn al-Jawzi is at places too severe in Tablis o Iblis, as is his verdict symbolic of his extremist views. Yet, the book contains a mine full of useful information, since it deals extensively with the vices found among different sections of the people. One has generally to agree with Ibn al-Jawzi's analysis, which also gives an idea of the incisiveness of his intellectual grasp. Criticizing the scholars of his time, some of whom were engaged in unnecessary hair-splitting of legal issues, he writes, "One of the greatest weaknesses of these scholars is that they are preoccupied completely with vain discussions, but they do not pay heed to the scriptures, the traditions, and the biographies of the companions of the Prophet, which would have a better effect towards the purification of the soul. It hardly needs any emphasis that the discussions on the trifling issues like the kinds of impurities and the methods of purification would not make one tender-hearted or receptive to the awe of God. What is needed by man is the recollection of God and the discourses on the subject, so that these may create a lifetime longing for success in the life to come. There is no denying the fact that ethical issues are not beyond the sphere of Sharia, but these are by themselves not sufficient for achieving the ultimate objective. How can these persons be expected to follow the example of the pious souls of the bygone days, whose faith they profess to own, unless they endeavor to get at the state of ecstasy and propinquity to God attained by them? One should not lose sight of the fact that man is indolent by nature, and if left to himself, he would be inclined to follow the beaten track of his day. On the other hand, if he tries to cultivate the knowledge of belief and behaviors of the pious and elevated mentors of the former times, he would naturally try to make after their ways. A mentor of the yesteryears has well said that he would prefer a tradition that would make him soft-hearted to 100 legal decisions of a Qadi." In his critique of the preachers in the same book, Ibn al-Jawzi observes in his own words, "Most of these preachers are accustomed to using a grandiloquent and heavily embellished language which often means nothing. The greater portions of their discourses are devoted to the accounts of the prophets, of Prophet Moses, of the Mount Sinai, of Joseph, of Zulaikha, and the like, but they have hardly to say anything about the obligatory performances enjoined by the religion and how to avoid sins. How can their sermons prevail upon an adulterator to offer repentance, or else convince a woman to be faithful and maintain good relations with her husband? These discourses are completely devoid of ethical or religious teachings of the Sharia. This is also one of the reasons for these sermons being so popular, for the truth is always distasteful while the falsehood is pleasing. Further continuing on the subject, Ibn al-Jawzi observes, "It often so happens that the preacher is sincere and honest, but he wants to win over and dominate the heart of his audience. He wants to exhort admiration from them. A pure symptom of this vice is that if another preacher tries to help him or begins to deliver lectures to his audience, he does not like it, although a sincere person would have welcomed a helping hand in his endeavor." Ibn al-Jawzi also criticizes the scholars for their lack of sincerity. He writes, "If the students of any scholar leave the teacher to sit at the feet of another teacher, more learned and reputed than him, he feels a heart burning, which is not befitting a sincere scholar. Sincere savants and teachers are like physicians who treat people simply to develop the awe of God and bless with the contentment another physician who is able to cure their patient. In connection with the vices developed by the kings, rulers, and administrators, Ibn al-Jawzi has written the following words. These people prefer to pattern their behavior according to their own wishes rather than what Sharia has enjoined upon them. They would cut off the hand and execute a person even though it might not be lawful to do so. They labor under misconceptions that they do is essential as a matter of political exigency. This means, in other words, that the Sharia is incomplete and they are making it up the deficiency in Sharia. This is in reality a great deception created by Satan, for Sharia comprises divine guidance for the conduct of our temporal affairs, as well as it is unthinkable that the guidance vouchsafed by God should be deficient. God Almighty has ordained in the following words, we have not left anything incomplete in the scripture, and also there is none to amend our order. Thus, a man who wants to superimpose his own ideas over Sharia is in the garb of political exigency, really claims that the guidance vouchsafed to man by God is imperfect and incomplete. This is obviously blasphemous. Ibn al-Jawzi points out another weakness of the rulers and the administrators in the following words. Besides their persistence on their wrongful ways, they also ardently desire to pay a visit to some pious and godly personage for the purposes of seeking their benediction in their favor. The devil has brought them round to believe that the solemn invocation of the divine blessings by a godly person would make the burden of their sins lighter. This is, however, not the case. Once a trader whose goods have been withheld by a collector of toll tax went to reputed saint Malik bin Dinar and requested him for help, Malik bin Dinar went to the collector of the toll tax, who treated him respectfully and released the goods. Thereafter, the official asked Malik bin Dinar to pray for him, but Malik replied, ask this purse in which you keep the money acquired illegally to pray for you. How can I invoke blessings on you when countless people curse you? Do you think, Malik bin Dinar added, that God will accept the entreaties of a single individual in preference to the call of a thousand others? At another place, Ibn al-Jawzi has written the following words. The rich and the affluent have a great reward for such misguided mystics who approve of the hearing of songs and playing of musical instruments. They are lavish in spending their riches on these mystics, but would not part with a single shell for the sake of scholars. As a matter of fact, the scholars are like physicians on whose advice a man spends his money grudgingly only when he falls ill. On the other hand, the misguided mystics and the musicians, along with the singers, are like courtiers and flatterers who are normally hangers-on for every wealthy person. Likewise, they are devoted to the ascetics and other persons of assumed piety and prefer them to the doctors of the religion. they would readily submit to a charlatan attired as a mendicant. If he practices a pious fraud upon them, they are easily led astray and begin to sneer at the scholars for not being ascetics. However, to hold the ascetics in higher esteem than the scholars is simply ignorance and an insult to Sharia. These misguided persons should really be thankful to God that they were not present during the lifetime of the Prophet, for they would have turned apostate if they would have seen him taking wives, eating, wearing clothes, and enjoying honey. In his critique of the masses, Ibn al-Jawzi writes, Satan has misled the masses to believe that attending of religious sermons and raising a wail of woe are highly meritorious acts, and the sole purpose of delivering these sermons. It is perhaps because the people had been told about the merits of listening to these discourses, but they do not know that at the end of these sermons is the reformation of their own morals and rectitude of their behavior. Nor do they appear to be aware that whatever they listen to in these lectures will be cited as evidence against them on the day of judgment. I personally know a number of people who are attending such discourses for a number of years. They get excited on hearing these sermons, burst into tears, but they still persist in accepting interest, cheating others in trade, remaining unmindful of their religious performances and disobedience to their parents. Satan has led them to believe that their presence in these sermons, their lamentations and fits of crying, will atone for their neglected duties and the sins of omission and commission. There are also others who think that accompanying the pious and the godly persons or paying visits to them shall be enough for removing their sins. In regards to the rich and the affluent, Ibn al-Jawzi has said the following. Many among these people spend lavishly on the construction of mosques or on the bridges, but their object really is to become famous and win over the people with such acts of piety. Another objective they have in view is that they should be remembered after their death, and for the purposes they get their means inscribed on the foundation stone of their edifices. Had they undertaken the construction of these works for the pleasures of God, they would have been content with the knowledge that God is aware of what they have done. If these persons were to be asked to get simply a will constructed without having the names inscribed on it, they would never agree to it. Likewise, these people donate candlesticks to the mosque during the month of Ramadan, although these remain without light during the remaining part of the year. They cannot obviously evoke admiration of others by providing oil for daily lighting, which they hope to attain by donating a single candlestick during the month of Ramadan. Sayyid al-Khatir. Not strictly an autobiographical work, this book contains reminiscence of Ibn al-Jawzi, his ideas and feelings and personal experiences. In describing the incidents he has come across, Ibn al-Jawzi frankly admits his mistakes and weaknesses very clearly. Ibn al-Jawzi often addresses his own self to criticize its longings and aspirations and gives an account of his mental and emotional states, describes his social experiences with the help of common and everyday happenings, and relates the wisdom derived from the trials and tribulations, rough and tumble of life, or his dealings with women, friends, and servants. An outstanding feature of this book is the immaculate sincerity and the simplicity. The book is also noted for the easy eloquence and lucidity of its style, which marks the first attempt made by an Arab writer in this direction, since the then prevailing style was to use heavily embellished language in the literary works. Ibn al-Jawzi possesses a special gift to draw wisdom from insignificant occurrences which many of us came across and pass over without paying any heed to them. Here is an example from the book Sayyid al-Khatir. Pater. I saw two laborers who were carrying a heavy beam, both of them humming a song. When one recited a verse and the other listened to it attentively and then repeated it or came out with another verse in reply to the first, I thought that they do not do so would have a greater consciousness of their exertion. By singing, the laborers made their work easier. On further reflection, I found that by engaging themselves in singing, the minds of the laborers get a little respite. They get busy in another work for a shorter duration and thus refresh themselves. This diversion also decreases the consciousness of the burden by diverting attention from the exertion of the work. My attention was diverted from it to the burden of responsibilities and obligations enjoined by the Sharia. I thought that perhaps the consciousness of these liabilities constitute the heaviest burdens on the self of a man, while the greatest effort lies in controlling and checking the propensities and the impulses for which the self has a liking. Thus I arrived at the conclusion that one should cover the path of endurance with the help of giving it necessary respite, and by allowing the consciousness to refresh itself by yielding to lawful pleasures. A poet has rightly said that when a caravan gets tired of traveling for the whole night, tell the people that the dawn is at hand and they would get the needed respite during the day. A similar story is told about Bishr Hafi, who was going somewhere along with a companion. The friend of Bishr Hafi got thirsty and he asked Bishr to wait a bit so that he could get some water from the well. Bishr, however, advised him to wait until they reached the next well and then to the next one. After they had covered a considerable distance, Bishr told his friend that life is this terrestrial world is also a journey which can be completed in that manner. The truth is, whoever is aware of the fact alluded to by Bishr will console his self, cheer it up when in distress, and assure it of lessening the burden so that it may bear the weight of its responsibilities with endurance. A certain preceptor of the time past addressed his self thus in the following words: O myself, if I check you from your fancies and attractions, it is only on account of my attention for you. Another master has once said, I used to lead my wailing self flooded with tears towards God, and then it gradually got familiar with the way and began to forge ahead cheerfully. It should thus be remembered that it is absolutely necessary to console and enliven the self so that it may bear its burden patiently. In another place in the book, he writes, I have seen that when hounds pass by the side of the wild dogs bark at them and try to chase them. The wild dogs are envious of the hounds because of their dog belts and clothing, but the hounds do not pay any attention to them as if they do not even belong to the same species. The wild dogs are fat and clumsy and are not trustworthy. The hounds, on the other hand, are lean, well-proportioned, and quick. They are also well-trained and trustworthy. It is out of the fear or on account of gratitude to their master that they bring back the game to him. I have drawn two conclusions from this comparison. First, the frame and appearance of a man has a bearing upon his morals. If the former has a finer countenance, the latter would have a nice demeanor. Secondly, nobody is envious towards the one whom he does not consider his equal. Likewise, a man who has been favored by God with faith and wisdom bears no ill will against those who lack these qualities, even though the latter might be moved by jealousy towards him. In fact, the faithful does not consider the faithless worthy of his attention, for their spheres of hope and aspirations are quite different. One harbors a feeling of hostility at another's good in this world and the other aspires for success in the world to come. There is a world of difference between the two. Dialogue with the Self by Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi sometimes applies the method of tracing an incident to its source so as to discover the general principles underlying that phenomena. Once he prayed to God along with another saintly person. The prayer was answered by God, and this made him to think as to whose prayer had found favor with God. Here Ibn al-Jawzi analyzes the incident with the help of self-dialogue. Once I was conflicted with a difficulty for which I had to invoke divine blessings and succor. Accordingly, I prayed to God along with another godly person. I felt that my prayer was about to be answered by God, but I thought that it was not account of my beseeching, but because of the prayer of that pious soul. I said to myself, I am aware of my own sins and weaknesses, which should not apparently allow my prayers to be answered, but who knows that God did not really accede to my own prayers. I felt that although the reverend man of God who prayed for me should be free of those vices which I knew I suffered from, still there was a difference between him and myself. I had a sense of regret for my sins while he was cheerful and enlivened, and it is not unoften that the broken-hearted penance is more accepted on occasions like this. There is, however, another matter in which both of us stood on equal footing. None of us solicited the favor of God on the grounds of moral excellence. Now, if in these circumstances I owned my mistakes and humbly prayed to God, take pity on me, O Lord, for I am empty-handed, and there was every likelihood of my supplication having been granted. Also, it is just possible that the other person might have had an eye on his actions, which would have caused hindrances in the acceptance of his prayers. Therefore, O myself, you should not make it insufferable for an already broken-hearted man like myself. I am aware of my guilt, and I do also confess my sins, while at the same time I am aware of what I implore and have a faith in the beneficence of my Lord, to whom I prefer my entreaties. God may bless that devoted soul if he lacks this quality, but so far as I am concerned, the confession of my guilt is my most valuable possession. At another place, Ibn al-Jawzi again portrays his inner struggle in the following words. I was once undecided about a matter that was improper and unbecoming under the Sharia, but my mind had brought forth certain arguments in its favor, which apparently made it look lawful to me. In truth, however, it was nothing but reasoning, and that too speculative, because, as I later found out, it was manifestly abominable. However, I addressed myself to God and I implored God to ward off this state of indecision. I also began the recitation of the Quran so as to set my mind at rest. As I had to teach the commentary of the chapter Yusuf, I began my recitation from there. I was so engrossed with the problem that I had in my mind that I did not pay much attention to what I was reading. But I was taken aback when I recited the verse when Allah said, He said, I seek refuge in Allah. Oh, He is my Lord who has treated me honorably. I felt as if this verse has been revealed for myself. I said to myself, Did you follow it? Yusuf was free. He was wrongfully made a slave and sold to many people. Yusuf felt so grateful to the Aziz that he called him his Lord. Although neither Yusuf was a slave or the Aziz a master, the chief reason for this gratefulness of Yusuf was that the latter had treated him honorably. Now think of your own self. You are really the slave of a master who has been a benefactor ever since your birth. Nobody knows how many times he has overlooked your mistakes. You have to remember how he provided for your needs. It was by God's grace that you acquired knowledge and earned your living. He guarded you from every danger and guided you to adopt the right course. He saved you from the hostility of your enemies. He bestowed on you a godly appearance as well as an intellectual gift. He enabled you to master the science in a short duration, although others could not acquire these over a much longer period. He also favored you with eloquence, intellect, and memory, and caused the people to show you kindness and reverence, and made it easy for you to procure your livelihood without having to lie under an obligation to others. It is not possible, in truth and reality, to thank him for the innumerable favors he has bestowed on you, and the good-looking countenance, well-proportioned limbs, and worthy demeanor, refined taste, and intellectual grit and determination to adopt the right path and to avoid lewdness. The opportunity to acquire knowledge of the traditions and to act on it. Verily, if you would count the bounties of God, you cannot reckon it. How many of your enemies laid snares for you, but God saved you? How they wanted to discredit you, but God exalted you? How many favors were granted to you, but denied to others? How many people left this world broken-hearted, but you are crowned with success? Don't you see that you are in good health, have sound intellect, and a wholesome faith? Your knowledge is increasing, your aspirations are fulfilled, and if you are ever thwarted of any desire, God makes you patient and forbearing until you know that it was really profitable that your desire did not meet with success. It would be impossible to recount all the favors of God bestowed upon you, since the unknown bounties invested by God on man are far in excess that he can ever comprehend. Then, how did you consider it lawful to do something which was considered unclean by God? He then said, I seek refuge in Allah. He is my Lord, who has treated me honorably, and wrongdoers never would prosper. Ibn al-Jawzi narrates another incident in the following words. Once I acted on a legal opinion which was upheld by certain schools of jurisprudence but rejected by others. However, I felt an uneasiness as if I had committed a sacrilege, which was casting and taking away my spiritual contraction and a drift towards unorthodoxy. With a deepening sense of bereavement and sulliness, I realized, as if my own self was asking me, "You didn't act against the advice of the jurists. Why is then this feeling of privation?" I replied, "O my insinuating self, I have two answers to your question. First, you turned aside from the teachings of your own juristic school. If you had been asked to pronounce a legal opinion on this question, you would not have advised of this." "I would not have acted on it," interjected the self, "if I had not considered it lawful," I replied. "No. You would not have even advised others to act likewise, and the second reason is," I added, "that you should be happy over the gloom experienced by yourself, for had you not been favored with the illuminations, you would not have had the feeling of bereavement." "If I dislike the gloom coming over me," replied the self, "then you should make up your mind," said I, "to give up the disputed act. You think that it has been made lawful through consensus of opinion, still you should decide to pronounce it simply for the fear of God." And the self was then saved of the spiritual contraction and gloominess after it acted likewise. Biographical Studies by Ibn al-Jauzi. Ibn al-Jauzi was primarily a traditionalist and a jurist, but he always emphasized the importance of study of biographical accounts of the pious and saintly masters of the olden times for the purpose of purification of the soul and implanting a religious zeal. He has advised the scholars, jurists, and traditionalists in Talbis o Iblis or Sayyid al-Khatir to pursue this branch of learning. Speaking of his own experiences in this regard, he writes in Sayyid al-Khatir, "I feel that the study of juristic sciences and traditions is not sufficient to instill a tenderness of heart which enables it to attract divine grace. The only way to acquire this faculty is to study the inspiring biography of the masters who are pure of heart. The knowledge pertaining to the lawful and the unlawful matters does not produce the warmth and tenderness of heart. It is brought about by effective incidences narrated in the traditions and the biographical accounts of the mentors of the yesteryear. Those teachers of the olden times had realized the true content of faith and lived up to it instead of simply acquiring a knowledge of it. What I am recommending to you is my personal experience. I have seen that the traditionalists and their students generally devote their entire attention to the chain of narrators and the canons framed for the reception or rejection of traditions. Similarly, the jurists are extremely fond of the science of dialectics for gaining a victory over their opponents. How can these make one tender-hearted? Formerly, the people used to visit the men of God to pattern their behavior after the example set by the pious souls, instead of acquiring knowledge from them. And indeed, this is the end of knowledge. Therefore, let it be understood very clearly that it is absolutely necessary for you to include the study of the biographies of the pious and the reverend souls in your curriculum of law and tradition." Biographical writings. Ibn al-Jauzi has accordingly written the biographies of a number of luminaries such as Hasan al-Basri, Khalif Umar bin Abdul Aziz, Sufyan Thawri, Ibrahim ibn Adham, Bishr Hafi, Ahmad bin Hanbal, and others. In addition to these biographies, he has also written a compendium of reputed scholars, writers in 4 volumes under the title of Sifat as-Safwa. This book is really a revised edition of another book written by another scholar, which has been edited by Ibn al-Jauzi. The revising the book, he has kept in view the principles of historical criticism and deleted the spurious accounts related by the other scholar. Study of history. Ibn al-Jauzi held the view that along with the study of religious sciences like the laws and tradition, history should also be studied by the students, because lack of knowledge in this branch of learning has led certain scholars to commit unpardonable mistakes. He therefore advised that every student should have at least as much knowledge of history that does not commit grievous mistakes. He writes in Sayyid al-Khatir as follows: "A scholar jurist must be conversant with all the related sciences. A jurist has to have knowledge of other sciences like history, tradition, on which he has very often to rely upon. I heard a jurist saying that Sheikh Shilbi and Sadi Shureikh has once got together in a meeting. I wondered at the ignorance of the jurist who did not know that the two were not contemporaries. Another scholar once said in a lecture that since Khalif Ali had bathed the dead body of Fatima, their marriage did not terminate even after the death of Fatima. I thought, may God help this man, for he does not know that Khalif Ali had married the niece of Fatima, Umama bin Zainab, after Fatima had passed away. How would it have been possible if the marriage had been continued after the death of Fatima? I have never I have seen similar grievous mistakes committed by Imam Ghazali in Ihya Ulumuddin. I was surprised to see that he could mix up the incidences happening at quite different times. I have compiled all such errors of Ihya in one book. Another scholar, Sheikh Abul Marli, has mentioned another curious story in his book entitled Ash-Shamil on the subject of jurisprudence. He writes that certain Batinites have related that Hallaj, Abu Saud al-Jabani, and Ibn al-Muqnama had conspired to overthrow the then government by creating dissatisfaction amongst the masses. Each one of them undertook to raise insurrection in a certain county, and in accordance with the agreement went on to Baghdad. The two confidants of Hallaj were, however, of the opinion that he would surely lose his life because it was not possible to dupe the people of Baghdad. If the narrator of the story only knew that Hallaj was not a contemporary of Ibn al-Makan, he would have not given any credence to the story. Mansur had ordered the execution of Ibn al-Makan in 144 AH, while Abu Sa'id al-Jabani Qarmati came to prominence in 286 AH, and Hallaj was killed in 309 AH. Thus, Qarmati and Hallaj were almost contemporaries, but Ibn al-Maktama was born much earlier. There is no question of the three meeting and conspiring together. This would amply make it clear that every scholar should have a grounding in the sciences related to his own. It is discreditable to a traditionalist that he should not be able to give a legal opinion in any matter simply because he has been engrossed in the study of tradition and has no time to pay to attention to other branches of religious learning. Similarly, it does not behove a jurist to be unable to explain the meanings of any traditions. I implore God that He may endow us with the ambition that may not allow us to be put to such indolence. Historical writings. Ibn al-Jawzi did not merely criticize the scholars for not being well versed in history, but he also wrote a contemporary, comprehensive historical account of Islamic people from the inception of Islam till 574 AH in 10 volumes. In this work, Ibn al-Jawzi first gives the year and then narrates the important incidences and events of that year, along with the prominent persons who died during the year, followed by an account of their achievements. This work of Ibn al-Jawzi thus combines chronicles with scientific history interwoven with harmonious account of the notable personalities. Another historical work of smaller size of Ibn al-Jawzi is, as mentioned in the book, this is a comparison of historical information which has been published. The Oratory of Ibn al-Jawzi. The chronicles of his time agree that Ibn al-Jawzi was a gifted orator who could draw a very large crowd. In Sayyid al-Khatir, he has mentioned his internal struggle, which once almost prevailed upon him to pay absolutely no attention to the rhetoric and the choice of word in his speeches, as this could be construed as a show of oratory. However, he gave up the idea since further reflection he came to the conclusion that eloquence was a God-given gift and a perfection and not a defection which ought to be employed for the propagation of faith. Similarly, Ibn al-Jawzi entertained a desire not more than once to give up preaching and withdraw himself completely to a life of complete seclusion and meditation. However, he won over himself to follow the right path by arguing the issue with it. He ultimately decided that it was a suggestion hinted at by Satan, who did not like to see thousands of people being carried away by his eloquence towards the path of moral and spiritual reformation. The prophets of God were primarily preachers, and they were also associated with the people. The self of man, being indolent and abhorring exertion, wants to turn away and turn its back upon the world. It also is tempted by the love of fame, honor, and popularity, which can easily be gained through winning over the hearts of people by retiring from the world. Thus, Ibn al-Jawzi reasoned with the self to counter the whisperings of Satan, who wanted him to abandon his mission of preaching and inviting people towards the path of guidance. Ibn al-Jawzi thus continued to press his intellectual gifts for more than a half a century to the task of serving the people and reviving of the faith. Ibn al-Jawzi died Friday night in 597 AH. The entire population of Baghdad suspended its work to attend the funeral of Ibn al-Jawzi, which was held in the mosque of Jama' Mansur. It was a memorable day in the history of the city. Innumerable people were found sobbing for the departed teacher. The analysts report that quite a few inhabitants of Baghdad spent their night throughout the ensuing month of Ramadan at his grave, offering prayers and reciting Quran for the peace of his soul. Jazakallahu khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.